Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In this week's episode, we'll be investigating the case of a French billionaire and media tycoon, Patrick Drahi. He's under investigation by the UK government on the grounds of national security. This relates to his newly increased share in the previously state-owned telecoms company, British Telecom, or BT for short. Drahi's known to be a passionate Zionist and, as it turns out, in addition to his interesting connections in the media world, he's also linked to the Zionist entity's intelligence agencies. As in every show, I'll be speaking to experts to find out more. But first, we've got this special report by Bianca Rahimi on the UK's investigation of Patrick Drahi on the grounds of national security and what could be behind it.
Who is the Israeli billionaire whose takeover of British Telecom has prompted a national security probe? BT enjoys the custom of almost 30 million people across the UK. It is the largest provider of broadband communication services in the state. It has a significant presence in 180 different countries across the world. It lays claim to the backbone of British internet infrastructure and even handles key service contracts in government departments. However, in the last year, the mysterious French-Israeli billionaire Patrick Drahi has become the largest shareholder of the company, raising his stake to 18%. This move has prompted the British government to make use of the new National Security and Investment Act to investigate Drahi's Altice company on the basis of concerns around national security. But why would Patrick Drahi's majority ownership of British Telecom be an issue of national security? He has several key media and telecommunications interests in the Zionist entity and is pictured here warmly embracing Israeli Minister of Communications Moshe Kahlon. And the links do not end there. Drahi enjoys a fascinating relationship with Israel's military and intelligence institutions. Patrick Drahi's Israeli news channel I-24 has employed at least 35 former members of the Israeli military as staff, including Hannah Rifkin as an I-24 news correspondent who went from being the social media editor of the channel to the Israeli military and back to the channel. Polina Gariev, who is simultaneously the Germany correspondent for I-24 News, at the same time is working as a social media guru at DW, the German channel where Palestinians were cleansed from the workforce. She started her professional life as the news editor for the Israeli military magazine. David Matlin, the host of a daily flagship show on the I-24 News, is a former sergeant in the Israeli military and area director for Israel lobby group AIPAC. Another correspondent the channel employs is Eyal Pinko, who was the head of intelligence in the Israeli Navy and later worked as head of division in the Israeli Prime Minister's office. I-24 News also employed a former social media manager for the Israeli military, Daniel Tzemach, as a correspondent. He later went on to work as the international media manager and spokesman for the Israeli arms company Rafael Systems. Here, the channel boasts of its high level of access to Zionist intelligence figures.
Three former Israeli intelligence chiefs agreed to discuss the methods used by the agencies to fight Israel's enemies.
Patrick Drahi also took over the left-wing French newspaper founded by Jean-Paul Sartre, Liberation. In 2020, he appointed Dov Alfon, a former Israeli military intelligence agent of the infamous Unit 8200, as editor-in-chief of the newspaper. Drahi is also pictured here with Moshe Leon, mayor of Jerusalem, and Zev Elkin, Israeli minister of Jerusalem and Heritage Affairs, celebrating the laying of a cornerstone by his foundation in occupied Al-Quds. Though it has not been stated publicly, it is likely that the national security concerns about Patrick Drahi's takeover of British Telecom are Israel-related.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog, Spinwatch. Our expert guest today is Mick Napier, who spoke to us earlier from Edinburgh. Mick is the secretary of the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, and he's one of Scotland's most prominent advocates of the Palestinian cause. He's led a number of successful campaigns against the Zionist lobby, and he describes himself as a lifelong socialist and anti-racist, and the only Scot certified free of racism by two Scottish courts. Welcome to the show. David, let me start with you. What's the significance of British Telecom then?
Well, as viewers may or may not know, British Telecom is the formerly nationalised telecommunications company of the UK and runs all of the exchanges and the telephone systems in this country still. It was privatised by the Tories as part of their neoliberal selling off of the nation's assets to the highest bidder. And thus is a really significant concern in terms of the questions of national security. If you have a hostile foreign power taking over your internet and telephone services or having access to them in a greater way than they currently do, then that's a really significant issue for national security. And I guess that's what this national security investigation is all about, seeing whether there is access or potential access by a hostile foreign power to BT, should it be continuing under the ownership proportion that Drahi now has.
Mm. Well, we asked Mick about some of the consequences of BT's privatisation almost 40 years ago now.
Well, the company, like so many others, has utilised the myths of neoliberal economics to cut down on the workforce, to intensify the rate of work, and really to make sure that any wage rises do not keep pace with inflation. In this respect, they're similar to many, many other companies. But this is a key part of the British infrastructure for a key industry going forward in the 21st century. No one was surprised when BT Openreach employees embarked on a strike, the first national strike, I think, ever or for a very long time, because of the hollowing out of their conditions and salaries and general work-life balance being very unpleasant, yeah.
David, what do you know about this Patrick Drahi character?
So he's a French-Israeli billionaire. He's made money and been involved in media ownership. We saw in the film there his involvement in French media, in Israeli media, and also the expansion across into other countries such as Morocco, for example. So he's got big media interests. He's increases his proportion of BT to 18%, which is a very significant share. But also he has, in his media activities, shown his loyalty to the Zionist regime. So in particular, by censoring pro-Palestinian voices, but also by employing large numbers of intelligence agents from the State of Israel. So that's an indication that he has at least strong affinity with the State of Israel, and an indication of the problem that if he takes over British Telecom, as he now looks like he's got an almost controlling interest, whether that means that there will be access by Israeli intelligence agencies, including famously the Unit 8200, which is the signals intelligence unit like GCHQ and then in the UK and the National Security Agency in the US, which is involved explicitly with the surveillance of mass communications through organizations like British Telecom. So this is a guy who has a significant and serious conflict of interest, in which it's quite right that the British state should be investigating this. I hope that they will investigate this properly.
Mm, no, indeed. And given what you just said, a strong affinity could be seen as something of an understatement, strong affinity with Israel. It is something of an understatement. But we also asked Mick for his thoughts on British government investigating this takeover on the basis of national security.
Well, in a sense, they have to investigate it. They kicked up an enormous stink about Huawei being able to supply competitively in the international market equipment to be used in the electronics, internets, communication infrastructure here. And they flagged up the issue of national security. So they could hardly ignore Israel. Now, having said that, relations between Britain and Israel are so cozy at the top of the tree, not public opinion, but between elites, at least in the opinion of Israeli ambassadors, that it's very likely that the investigation will be cursory, will not really look at threats to national security. But there are many, and there's no question that the Israeli oligarchs who especially the one who already owns a huge chunk of BT, can't be assumed that they'll put British state political interests first. In fact, there's a long history of Britain overly trusting people who were assumed to have dual loyalty, but when push came to shove, their Israeli loyalty trumped their loyalty to the British state. I say that not as somebody who admires the British state, it's just an empirical fact. One can produce many examples of this.
I mean, David, you've been investigating Israeli spying missions in the UK, haven't you? I mean, and I guess that, you know, many people would probably be surprised that the Israeli spy agency, Mossad, is actively togs in Britain, because Israel's supposed to be an ally of Britain, isn't it?
It's supposed to be. But if you look back at the historical record, not just in the UK, but in the US too, let's take the example of the UK. You find that there are declassified MI5 files now. They're available on the internet. Anyone can look at them, which show that MI5 uncovered a spy in the top British intelligence organisation in the Cabinet Office in 1950 from Mossad. And they identified this guy, and they got rid of him, and they wrote in their internal files, now we realise that the Israelis are a hostile state. And this is MI5 writing in 1950. And since then, things haven't changed. Mossad has, of course, collaborated with British intelligence where it can, but where it wanted to, it's conducted operations systematically against this country and indeed against the US. In the US, they were doing this in terms of gun running back in the 1940s, but all the way through to the 80s, where the famous spy Jonathan Pollard was arrested for stealing nuclear secrets. And then back to this country, where there have been several instances down the years where Israeli spies have been expelled for breaking the rules for conducting covert operations in this country. And let's not forget, of course, Shai Massot, the Ministry of Strategic Affairs spy, who was unmasked by Al Jazeera and had to be hastily evacuated. That was an active covert operation by the Israelis to take down, in their own words, a government minister of the Conservative Party.
Yes.
So there is a long, long history of Israeli spies conducting operations against an alleged ally, the UK, and indeed in the US. And so we need to see this in the way in which the empirical evidence gives us the license for, which is that this is a hostile foreign state attempting to influence covertly the internal affairs of the UK. And in that light, the whole question about the Al-Drahi and national security becomes very, very important. It's certainly the case that MI5 or MI6 sometimes might turn a blind eye to an ally's misbehavior, but sometimes they don't. I mean, we can recall in the coalition government, for example, of David Cameron, that Pauline Neville-Jones was going to be appointed to a ministerial position, and her position was downgraded to a junior minister's position because she was felt by MI5 to have a conflict of interest because of her strong relationships with Ukrainian and Israeli oligarchs. So MI5 can put national security first and act against Zionists trying to infiltrate this country, and they should do so again.
I mean, this will be quite shocking, I think, to many viewers, because we've heard lots, haven't we, about Soviet spies in the 50s and the 60s and indeed the 70s and so on. Mm. I don't think I've ever seen anything actually in the British media. Certainly there's been no films like James Bond or anything like that sort of dealing with Israeli spies. So it is quite a shocking revelation there. So, I mean, in your opinion then, do you think Israel does represent a genuine threat to Britain's national security?
I think that the infiltration of Zionists in this country, just through the Israeli intelligence agencies, but also through the Zionist movement's infiltration of public institutions, I think that constitutes a genuine threat to national security and to the possibility that we can actually act independently in the world in a way which would be consistent with alleged British values, which are alleged to foster democracy, etc. If you're infiltrated by the Israelis, then that's going to be much harder than otherwise. So yes, I think this is a genuine question of national security, and I think it also applies to the US. I mean, the history of Israeli spy operations in the US is not widely known, but it's there on the public record. The documents have been declassified. There's tons of material on the internet should you wish to look.
Well, let's pause the discussion there for a moment to this report on the way in which Patrick Drahi uses his media power base to influence reporting about Palestine.
French writer Alain Grech has claimed that he was subject to censorship for his pro-Palestinian views on French channel BFM. Unsurprisingly, the widely followed digital news source is another plaything of Israeli billionaire Patrick Drahi. On the Middle East Eye website, Grech wrote, "After I criticize Israel over its latest assault on Gaza, French digital channel BFM TV took my clip offline and cancelled a follow-up interview." The Patrick Drahi-owned BFM channel claimed that this action was taken to, quote, avoid any manipulation of the footage. However, simultaneous to censoring pro-Palestinian voices like Grech, the channel presented a resident of Tel Aviv to present a passionately pro-Israel narrative. Palestine Declassified can reveal that not only is this gentleman, Julian Bahloul, a former employee of Patrick Drahi at his I-24 news channel, but he was also employed as a spokesman for the Israeli military less than 9 months ago. In fact, prior to his job at I-24 News, where he accompanied the Israeli Prime Minister on trips, he was a senior community manager for the Israeli military, in charge of managing the army's website, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Patrick Drahi's channel, I-24 News, was accused by ex-employees in a Haaretz investigation of practicing an Israeli regime-dictated cancel culture. Former journalists alleged that Israeli journalists like Omer Oren had been disinvited from appearing on the channel specifically at the behest of the Israeli Prime Minister's office. In another case, it was claimed that Odilia Carmon had been banned from the channel following an intervention from Yair Netanyahu. His father, Benjamin Netanyahu, was in government. It seems large-scale censorship in favor of the Israeli regime has taken place at Patrick Drahi's news channels. Can he be trusted to own British Telecom?
Well, we showed that to Mick earlier and asked him why Drahi's clear links with the Israeli government and its intelligence services are not being explored by Britain's corporate media.
I have genuinely been shocked by the discipline and the almost the totalitarian responses of the British media, over the current proxy war between NATO and Russia. It's remarkable the degree of discipline. So one can be quite sure that on a matter such as this, the oligarchs who own the British media or control the British media, the main state actors, and Mr. Drahi will be in consultation. They might not all attend the same clubs on Pall Mall in London, but they have many, many back channels for communication. And it's very likely that Britain's express statement that Israel is a key ally will trump fears about divided loyalties, which are quite obvious.
David, is this shareholder takeover a new tactic of Zionist actors? I mean, have we seen anything like this before?
It's not new, no. I mean, there are plenty of examples of Zionist involvement in media companies and social media companies. I mean, let's take the example of Newsweek, for example, the American news magazine. I mean, that in 2014 was reporting quite candidly on the history of Israeli spy operations in the U.S., Now, that's since been taken over by Zionist-friendly forces, and that's been the same for many other news organizations. Sometimes it's through non-Jews who take over companies, like the example of the Murdoch Empire. Rupert Murdoch, of course, is not Jewish, but is very strongly pro-Zionist in all his outputs. So you can see there is a pattern here, which is that Zionists who are in the media business, or indeed sometimes outside the media business, do make an attempt to try and control the levers of public perception through media ownership activities.
Yeah. Well, Mick also gave us his response to Drahi's channel I-24 News opening a branch in Morocco a few months ago, and what that says about the Abraham Accords as a mechanism of economic integration.
Well, we remember that Morocco agreed to the Israeli, to the US embassy being shifted to Jerusalem, in return for which Trump gave them, much as imperial powers have traditionally given huge chunks of real estate in Africa and Asia, but Trump gave Western Sahara to Morocco, completely in contravention to international. But I'm not sure that the overriding aspect of the Abraham Accords is economic. I think it's valuable for Israel, but I think it's overwhelmingly strategic to secure alliances with the United Arab Emirates, Morocco, consolidate the very shaky one with Egypt, and open up one publicly with Saudi Arabia in order to be allowed in full security to get on with the task of dispossessing the Palestinians.
David, there was a great deal of fuss kicked up a couple of years ago about the Chinese company Huawei's proposed deal with the UK, wasn't there? I mean, you remember the claims that it posed a threat to national security. I mean, do you think it's this investigation will conclude that Drahi is, or his company anyway, does actually pose a threat to national security?
I don't think it's impossible. I mean, I think that there are clearly elements of the British security state who see the genuine threat which the Israelis pose to British foreign policy, and indeed British domestic policy. I mean, the idea of Israeli intelligence agencies, Unit 8200, with which Rahi has particular connections, having access to the British telecom backbone and internet services is a clear threat to national security. And anyone in MI5 who concludes that it's not, you know, would be mad. So there will be people in MI5 who are looking at this and seeing this as a real issue. But the question is whether they'll be able to express that, whether that will be able to be the conclusion of the reports. The same thing happens in the US. The State Department historically has been very skeptical about Israeli involvement in US politics, but the politicians have always trumped that and said, no, we don't want to do this. Mm. They're an ally. Let's not do this. But it's not impossible that there will be material in there which ministers will see confidentially, which will lead to say, actually, his share in the company should be limited. Now, that would be a good thing. Yeah. And let's speak to MI5 about this directly. Yeah. MI5 should properly investigate this and should properly hold Drahi to account.
Well, it's certainly be significant if they do. But finally, we asked Mick whether the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign is currently battling on any issues at the moment.
Well, we've emerged from lockdown much weakened, but we want to ramp up the campaign again. We notice that Palestine Action are very much focused on Elbit, the Israeli arms company, UK-wide. And I'll be going to the Glasgow court in support of those who were arrested for their direct actions in Glasgow recently. But Elbit also owns this malign surveillance technology in Glasgow city centre. So we would hope to cooperate with everyone who recognises how bizarrely intrusive. I mean, it doesn't just raise questions about Palestine and Scotland. It raises questions about the right of human beings to have a private life, free from saturation level state surveillance. So we would be interested to work with others in order to promote this important campaign, because we're absolutely sure that if the people of Glasgow were aware about what was going on in the city centre, they would be very unhappy about it indeed.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, as unfortunately we're out of time again. Thanks for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
The notorious Guantanamo Bay prison is an ample proof that the United States is a terrorist regime. Reports of torture and violation of human rights in this infamous prison is indicative of the fact that the U.S. is the biggest sponsor of state terrorism. If the United States wants to counter terrorism, instead of waging endless wars around the world and causing civilian death and destruction, it should start from itself. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. The title of this article is Guantanamo Proof of U.S. Being a Terrorist Regime. Stay with us, please. The website of Crescent International has recently wrote, given the degree of ignorance among most Americans, it is safe to assume that many would not know what Guantanamo Bay represents or where it is located. Even if they knew, most would not care. After all, their heads have been stuffed with such vile propaganda about the threat of terrorism that they have come to believe those held there deserve what to be punished. Opened in January 2002, a few months after 9/11 attacks, at its peak, it held 779 prisoners. They were the worst of the worst. In the infamous words of Donald Rumsfeld, worms have probably consumed his stinking body by now as he awaits his rightful place in the lowest depth of hell. But more than 20 years after it was opened, Guantanamo Bay still holds 36 detainees as of July 25th, 2022. Only a handful, less than 10 men, are charged with involvement in 9/11 attacks, but their trials have not been held even at the Kangaroo Military Tribunal. Most of the rest are either cleared for release or await judgment on their release. They have not been charged with any crime. Guantanamo represents American lawlessness at its worst. According to the United Nations, such detentions have always triggered controversies over legality. Not only does the U.S. illegally occupy Cuban territory, but most detainees have not been tried according to U.S. laws. Further, international human rights organizations have not been allowed to visit the facility, again in clear violation of international law and the Geneva Conventions. 2 days after he was sworn in as President of the United States in January 2009, Barack Obama signed the 13,492 executive order. It was titled Review and Disposition of Individuals Detained at the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base and Closure of Detention Facilities. Its intended aim was to close the torture camp permanently. During his 8 years in office, Obama was able to reduce the number of detainees from 277 in 2008 to 91 in 2016, but he was unable to close it. American general threatened him with dire consequences if he closed Guantanamo Bay. Even Joe Biden, who served as Obama's vice president, vowed to close the torture camp, but it still remains open. Away from the prying eyes of journalists as well as human rights organizations, American soldiers and CIA agents have inflicted horrific torture on innocent people. Euphemistically called enhanced interrogation technique, torture was widespread. Sleep deprivation, holding detainees in stressful positions, and other forms of barbaric practices were routinely inflicted on the detainees. Their only crime was to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. To get a glimpse into what the detainees suffered, a few examples would suffice. Omar Khadr, captured in eastern Afghanistan in July 2002, he was shot twice in the chest by American occupation troops and barely survived. He was moved to Bagram Air Base, which served as America's first torture location. While his wounds were still raw, Khadr, 15 at the time, was subjected to brutal torture. In October 2002, he was chained to the floor of a U.S. transport plane in extremely stressful position and shipped to Guantanamo Bay. His real torture began there because he was accused of being an Al-Qaeda child. Every soldier took turns to inflict their own punishment on him. Even the Canadian government, led by the racist Stephen Harper at the time, joined in inflicting harm on him. Had it not been for Khadr, lawyers Dennis Edney and Nate Whitling, he would still be languishing in Guantanamo. Brought to Canada in 2012 under a plea bargain, Khadr won his release in 2015 and received $10.5 million in compensation from the Canadian government in 2017 for violating his charter rights. He was guilty of nothing. He was the victim of American barbarism, aided and abetted by the likes of Harper and his right-wing anti-Muslim bigots. And we have other examples, including Saifullah Paracha. The 74-year-old Pakistani businessman was captured in Thailand in 2003 and brought to Guantanamo in September 2004. He was accused of being an Al-Qaeda facilitator because he had exchanged money for two of the alleged hijackers that he did not know. Would a grocery store owner be charged if the alleged hijackers had brought groceries there? Pracha was cleared for release last year after his son, Ozair, also accused of terrorism, had his charges thrown out by a New York judge in March 2020. Allegations against Ozair as well as his father were based on confessions extracted under torture from detainees at Guantanamo Bay. The son was sent to his native Pakistan. The elderly Pracha, suffering from multiple ailments, has still not been released, even though the review board declared that he was no longer a threat to the U.S. He never was. And Abu Zubaydah was subjected to the most brutal forms of torture. He was captured in August 2002 by FBI, CIA, and General Pervez Musharraf intelligence agents in Faisalabad. Abu Zubaydah was accused of a laundry list of terrorist acts. Donald Rumsfeld said he was, if not the number two, very close to the number two person in Al-Qaeda. The Central Intelligence Agency informed Assistant Attorney General Jay Bai that he served as Osama bin Laden's senior lieutenant. In that capacity, he has managed a network of training camps. He also acted as Al-Qaeda coordinator of external contacts and foreign communications. CIA Director Michael Hayden would tell the press in 2008 that 25% of all the information his agency had gathered about Al-Qaeda from human sources originated with one other detainee and him. George W. Bush would use his case to justify the CIA's enhanced interrogation program, claiming that he had run a terrorist camp in Afghanistan where some of the 9/11 hijackers trained and that he helped smuggle Al-Qaeda leaders out of Afghanistan so they would not be captured by U.S. military forces. But As Rebecca Gordon exposes in her brilliant article in Counterpunch, none of it was true. During the operation to capture him, Abu Zubaydah was severely injured, shot in the thigh and stomach. Without immediate medical attention, he would have died, but the CIA wanted him alive, so it flew in an American surgeon to patch him up. The agency's concern was not humanitarian. The CIA wanted him alive to be able to interrogate him, hoping to extract information from him. Ms. Gordon reveals that Abu Zubaydah had the dubious luck to be the subject of a number of CIA firsts. The first post-9/11 prisoner to be waterboarded. The first to be experimented on by psychologists working as CIA contractors. One of the first of the agency's ghost prisoners. Detainees hidden from the world, including International Committee of the Red Cross, which, under the Geneva Conventions, must be allowed access to every prisoner of war. And one of the first prisoners to be cited in a memo written by Jay Bybee for the Bush administration on what the CIA could legally do to a detainee without supposedly violating U.S. federal laws against torture. While he was accused of all kinds of misdemeanors, his real crime was that in 1980s, he helped run the Khaldun camp. This was a training facility set up in Afghanistan with CIA help during the Soviet occupation of that country. In other words, Abu Zubaydah was like Osama bin Laden, an American ally in the fight against the Soviets. Abu Zubaydah's horrific torture, including waterboarding, sleep deprivation, slamming against a concrete wall, reflects the true nature of American elite. They are the real terrorists. If there were any justice in the world, American officials involved in authorizing such horrific torture would be put on trial and publicly executed.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, din al-Azam, ghayr din Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Are going to talk about some of the Islamic laws about medical issues and conditions according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography and we'll be back. Don't go away.
little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Chesawit, since we are talking about some of the Islamic laws related to medical conditions and issues, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, let me ask you this question. Is it permissible to implant hair on the head of a person who suffered, for example, from burns, so much so that they are put under immense psychological pressure because of it?
Well, there's no harm in it. There's no harm in the implant, in implanting hair on the head of a person.
Yes.
Provided that the implanted hair is taken from an animal whose meat is halal or a human hair is used, okay? And there's one thing more important to be noted, and that is the hair should not be used, it should not be, implanted in such a way that, for example, they are glued to the individual's head and they look like fake hair, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Planting means that there are seeds and those seeds are planted inside the individual's head or skull or scalp, and then those hairs or strands of hair gradually begin to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And that looks like natural hair. So as long as the hair of an impure animal is not used, and as long as the hair of a human being is used, there is no objection. There is no problem.
I see. My next question, or even more questions, are related to transplantation. We know it's a common area now in the field of science, medical science. Sheikh Javid, is it permissible to use the blood vessels of a dead person for, the transplantation in the body of another person who's still ill?
Grand Ayatollah Khamenei maintains that there is no objection to using the blood vessels of a dead person,
mm-hmm.
And if it is done with the permission of that individual in his lifetime, of course, it's absolutely permissible. And when it is done with the permission of the guardian of the deceased person or the dead individual, again, it is permissible,
mm-hmm.
because if the, as you rightly mentioned, because the transplantation of takes place when there is an ill individual or a patient who needs the transplantation. So if that is the objective, to save the life of a respectful person or the respectful life of an individual who is in need of the transplantation, Ayatollah Khamenei says that it is permissible, provided that the consent or the permission of the dead person should have been obtained before he died, or the consent of his guardian is obtained.
I see. Probably that's because of that we have certain transplantation banks in some certain hospitals where you give your consent while you're still alive and you receive a transplantation card that you can carry around with you. And when something like an accident happens to that individual, then they, for example, enter a coma state, then they can use, for example, some of their organs probably,
yes,
actually,
right,
to be transplanted to another person. Sheikh Javid, thank you very much for your nice answers. And then let's take a short break and then we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the Islamic laws related to the medical conditions according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Before the break, I asked you a question about the transplantation of a blood vessel of a dead person, that you said that it's related to the consent of the person, right?
Yes.
There is another question related to that, but it's related to the kidney transplant, all right?
Yes.
Since having a kidney transplant would definitely improve the patient's conditions, considerably, of course, there has been an intention to set up a kidney bank.
Yeah.
All right? Or transplantation bank, probably. This is bound to encourage people to donate or sell their kidneys willingly out of their consent.
Yeah.
Is it permissible, Sheikh Javid, to donate or sell one's body part by choice? All right?
Yes.
Or consent, whether it's a kidney or any other organ? And what is the ruling in emergency conditions?
Well, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, there is no objection to a living mukallaf, a living duty-bound person,
mm-hmm.
donating or selling his organs in order that the sick may use of them or make benefit, make use of those organs, provided that he will not be considered, provided that such a thing does not lead to considerable or substantial harm, and it does not actually lead to some kind of significant damage to his body or to his health. And indeed, of course, this becomes obligatory when it becomes the only way to save a respectful life. When there is a life, respectful life, and saving that depends on, let's say, on giving a kidney, then it becomes, you know, obligatory, you know. But it is necessary to understand that it should not lead to a kind of unbearable situation, and it should not lead to substantial or significant damage to his health. And in this condition and in this assumption, if there is no substantial damage to the individual's health, of course, it is permissible, quite permissible.
Mm-hmm.
And good for the individual to donate or even sell his organs, because his organ belongs to him and he can sell it. He can sell it if he wants to. And there are people out there who, of course, sell their organs, maybe because of some reasons, including need for money or need for to support their life, family, of course, financially. They do it.
I see. Okay, Chef Tarbit, let me ask you a short question. Someone says, I have expressed my wish to donate my organs after my death. I was told that I should make a will in this regard and inform any heirs. Have I the right to do so? Do I have the right to do so?
Well, there is no harm in making use of a dead person's organs for transplantation in the bodies of other people who are in need in order to save their lives and, of course, to treat their illnesses. And it is absolutely permissible. And, of course, there is no objection to writing a will or to leaving a will directing the individuals or stating clearly that one of his organs may be used to save another person's life. So, of course, we do see in our day-to-day life there are people who leave a will stating mm-hmm. clearly
yes.
And directing his heirs to transplant or to sell one of his organs in the event that he, for example, makes an accident and he is dead. So one of his organs can be removed and it can be transplanted to another person
yes.
who is in need of it, or it can be sold to another person. So such a there is no objection and there is no harm in making use of a dead person's, of course, organs for transplantation, provided that it should be with the permission of the mukallaf, the duty bound person, or his heirs.
Uh-huh. Thank you very much, Sheikh Rabi. Thank you very much for listening to our program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.